Hello, welcome. This is Aaron Insights, and yes, you're in for a surprise. That's right. It's not being hosted by Sven Longshanks. It's being hosted by Grandpa Lampshade. Glad you could join us. This is something I've been kind of teasing. I've been working on an idea, wanting to do something else. As you all well know, the current show I do is not really formatted to getting to sit down and visit with other people. And I was talking with Sven Longshanks recently about how I really, miss being able to do that. And he's like, well, you should use the Aaron Insights platform for that. And I took him up on that. And so this is going to be a real treat. I'm looking forward to being able to do it. I don't know how often we'll do these things, but when the opportunity comes up, we're going to do it. And today's for a maiden voyage of the GPO hosting of Aaron Insights, I had the number one top guy on my list. I've been dying to sit down and visit with. And, he's gracious enough to take me up on it. I'm really, really glad. And you're in for a treat. If you're a regular Lampshade listener and you haven't been able to catch any of this guy's work, you're in for a treat. And I am talking about Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, host of the Orthodox Nationalist and also appears weekly on the Daily Nationalist right here on this network. So, Dr. Johnson, how are you doing?
You know, I'm calling you Grandpa from now on. My grandparents died in the 80s, if not before. So I'm adopting you. I don't know how old you are. It doesn't matter. So I have a grandfather now. You're my grandfather. I'm going to come to you for all kinds of advice and stuff like that. So this is a new relationship that's developing here.
It sounds good. And you could do worse. You know, I don't know that you could probably also do better, but hey, I'll take you up on it. And this, folks, is one of the great things when you get the opportunity. Anytime you get the opportunity to sit down and visit with somebody, one of the things people should get over, because if you seek wisdom, you seek truth. And one of the real steps to seeking wisdom is getting over the phobia that so many people have, which is that of sitting down and visiting with somebody that you know is smarter about things than you are. And you got to get over that, because that's how you're going to learn and that's how you're going to gain wisdom. And that's the case today. This is my own greedy self-interest here. I mean, I get to be generous in introducing Lampshade listeners that might not have listened to Dr. Johnson before. But this is also greedy on my part, because I get to sit down and talk about this topic that been on my mind for some time. With somebody who's honestly leaps and bounds more well-researched and versed in this topic than I am. So, again, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and have this visit.
Well, I need to explain something to you. You know, I'm good at two things. I'm a very good historian, and I make very, very attractive babies, very cute babies. Otherwise, I'm pretty useless to the world. So, you know, this is, I'm a scholar. It doesn't mean I'm intelligent, because I could be an idiot about a lot of things. So let's get that straight right off the bat.
Well, our topic today, you will not be an idiot on, because I've listened to quite a bit of your material on it. And that is our topic for the day, is the perception. I believe the false perception, and I think it's going to be safe to say that you agree with me on this, the perception of U.S. military superiority. And I want to really nail this down in the context of a conflict with a major power, such as Russia and China. I mean, we have the U.S. military has been kicked around by third world goat herders. And I've seen people that have this attitude like, well, that's only because it's like these guys are cheating because they won't line up in a row in a bunch of antique tanks so that we can shoot them down with our superior technology. They're cheating. That's the only reason we lost. And I've actually seen a number of people have this attitude like, but if we got into a conflict with Russia and China, it'd be a different story, buddy. Let me tell you, we're going to kick their ass. What we're going to do, you know, and I think that is not only laughable and foolhardy, but actually extremely dangerous. What do you think, Matthew?
You know, every time I think of the stereotypical American patriot guy, he's speaking in exactly that voice. You've got the voice. You're like better than Jeff Foxworthy. You got it perfectly done. You're like Larry the Cable Guy. You got it perfectly right. That's exactly how I picture it. I've confronted some of these guys before, both in and out of uniform. I come from a military family. I'm the only one who had nothing to do with it. But I come from a family of grunts. Who hate the upper brass. My contempt for the American military is usually for officers, mid-level and up. There's a reason why the Americans have lost every single war, except maybe for Grenada. Even in Grenada, there was huge losses. Maybe Panama, which didn't put up any resistance. The issue is not so much they didn't line up, they didn't fight like the British would, that they fight back. They shoot back. If you shoot back, you got a problem. You know, I confronted two Air Force captains at a 7-Eleven in West Virginia or Maryland. And they were talking to the clerk about allegedly bombing some group in Afghanistan. I was suspicious, you know, stolen valor's everywhere, stupid, you know, these guys are, but you know, they seem legit. And on their way out, I stopped them and I said, what's this group again? That you? And they expected me to be all over, oh, you're so wonderful. And so, oh yes, some name, they may have made it up. I never heard of them before. I said, well, could they shoot? You did this from the air, right? Can they shoot back? And they said, well, they probably wouldn't know what an AA battery was if it rolled on them. I said, so you slaughtered them. What did they do? I mean, how much of a threat could they have possibly been if you could just do that? You just slaughtered them. So by this argument now, you know, if my child is in the playground and some little kid bothers them, I could go smash his head in because he gets him. That's what you're doing. I said, how is it you coming back here and daring to call yourself a combat vet for doing this? And you guys lost anyway. And then in the back of the store, I didn't even see the guy. In the back of the 7-Eleven, some guy yells out, yeah, they're in the way of all the heroin distribution. And the clerk kicks me out of the store and I leave. I said, go back to looking at porn or something like that. And I walked out of the store. I shoplifted a Snickers by accident because I had it in my hand. And, you know, I'm lecturing these two captains. Both of them were captains. They weren't – I expected them to be resistant to me and to be nasty, to be different. No, they kind of just looked at me. One had a faint smile on his face. But they listened to everything I said. I said, you guys are absurd. This isn't warfare. And you guys lost anyway. But, you know, you mentioned something too. They're always making excuses. They're always – this is these supposed to be these tough, invincible guys. It's either the politicians – we're not getting enough money. We're not getting enough support or equipment. We're not getting enough – there's always some stupid excuse as to why they lose everywhere. The U.S. just negotiated a surrender to the Taliban, as I predicted several years ago, because as the Russian – I read a lot of Russian military forums, and they're not worried about the Americans. They go on an American base. The Serbs who went on to the base, the huge base in Kosovo, Bonsteel. And they're shocked by the decadence and the luxury and the prostitution and the drugs, everything that's available in these places. These are luxurious, at least for officers anyway. And the pay scale is – and so that's what's motivating these guys. They come up against a determined, militant, well-organized group, however small it might be, and they're going to get beaten. And that's what's happened everywhere. So the Russians and the Chinese, because they'd be fighting together. The U.S., the Allies would abandon them. The Germans will not do anything. The French already said they're not going to do anything. The Turks aren't going to do anything. They could rely on Britain and maybe Japan in the case of any kind of conflagration. The U.S. is pushing and pushing and pushing, and the result is going to be disastrous for this country.
Well, when people bring up, you know, the politician, the reason these – they've been unsuccessful. The politicians won't let the generals win. That tells you right there that somebody doesn't grasp – how these things work. I mean, the politics of it is every bit of as much a part of these conflicts as the weaponry. I mean, as the saying goes, war is just politics by other means. And in one of your excellent presentations recently was on the Crimean War, and you know, the history books record a certain way. But when you look at, okay, well, what were the long-term goals of, say, England? And in the end, they didn't achieve any of them. So even with the fact that essentially Russia managed to hold its own in this conflict, as far as the long-term goals, and that's the whole purpose of the war. I mean, the people are always given an excuse. You know, this is the narrative of why we're going to war. But that's just to get you to go along with going and, you know, or sending your kids to go get their legs blown off. The real reasons are, you know, these political goals, these goals that these governments have, and whether or not they achieve those goals is really – when you look at it, I think where, you know, victory is defined. Do they achieve those goals? And of course, again, they're not going to tell the people, oh, well, we're going to go to war because they don't have a central bank and they really need to have one because we have to have a monopoly on central. Because no, who's going to send their kid go get their legs blown off for that? Nobody. Nobody's going to do that. So they have to give you some, we're going to fight for the democracy and the freedom. And he's gassing his own people. You know, believe it because we tell you they're doing this. And so the people are just given these reasons. But the point is that the politics is every bit as much of the point. In fact, it's more the point of the war itself than the weaponry, than any other. It's politics by other means. So when you sit there, when somebody sits there and says, well, the politicians wouldn't let them win, that's every bit as much of a failure as if they launched airstrikes and all the planes fell out of the sky because they were poorly designed. Don't you think?
Well, that's actually happening. Because there's so much the U.S. military is so overstretched. They have tons of money, but they're undermanned. The morale is zero. Suicide rates continue to go up. And as I predicted several years ago, desertion is now a quiet crisis. The truth of the matter is, and I remember when the first Iraq war hit. I was 19, just in college, and I followed that like a hawk. And I noted there was a problem with it. The Iraqi army was large, trained by the Soviets. They were dug in for months waiting for the Americans. They were combat experienced because they've been fighting the Iranians in the 80s. And I was told that the U.S. suffered almost no casualties and they just rolled over them. And I said, that can't be true. There's no way that a dug in experienced army could just be rolled over by the U.S. It turns out it was a lie. And it was completely by – I mean I knew – I never had the hard evidence until a few years ago I stumbled across a Russian language military blog citing all kinds of intelligence, not just from Russia but from other countries. And of course the Russians were actually there in an advisory capacity for the Iraqi army. But the American casualty rate was extremely high, especially in the air. Now the U.S. government has absolutely no obligation to tell anyone the truth about this. Every country lies about its casualties. But the U.S. lost many, many men and many planes, a huge number of them. This is why they had to call out the reserves. This is why Saddam Hussein remained in power. They were they got a bloody nose. None of it was true. And it made perfect sense to me. When you lose a son or in battle, and it's always a boy, it's not men and women, I hate that. When you lose a son in battle, you sign a non-disclosure agreement. You can't talk about it if you want to receive death benefits. I remember when the Pentagon ordered a huge number of body bags in the, I want to say maybe 92. It was actually a big story for like 2 hours and then suddenly quashed because far more were dying than if you remember during World War II, not remember, but have read about it. You weren't allowed, if you were a newspaper man, you couldn't run pictures of dead American, dead GIs until 1945, until Iwo Jima, Marines on the Beach, was the very first time, and I think it was Time magazine, that ran, they got into a lot of trouble for that. This is how governments are. The U.S. is particularly bad in this. But during the Cold War, the military had a bad reputation because they were allegedly supposed to be fighting communists in Korea, Vietnam, whatever. Suddenly, when the Cold War is over, the main targets are nationalist and religious governments, mostly in the Middle East and Central Asia, Israel's enemies. All of a sudden, and I distinctly remember this shift, this seismic shift that occurs in the early 90s, and especially after 9/11, where all of a sudden these men were heroes. These men were considered gods. Everyone was tying ribbons to things, and you couldn't criticize these guys. And I noted that, I was the only one who noted that all of a sudden – these men are heroes after being baby killers, where every ROTC building and on every campus in America went up in flames in the early 70s. All of a sudden, they're heroes. What the hell happened? And why is there no anti-war movement for a war that in Afghanistan is over? The U.S. lost, was surrendered to the Taliban. And negotiations haven't quite finished, but they're almost all out of there. These wars have dragged on for two decades. No anti-war movement to be found. Isn't that strange? And I began to realize that it was their target. It had nothing to do with the army. The military is, it has to do with, first of all, the fact that the military is a liberal institution. They celebrate Gay Pride Day. They have to. I could send you a link to their Air Force website. They have to celebrate, domestic violence. Their training is extremely – their feminist training, all kinds of sensitivity stuff they have to do. They hate it, but they have to do it. And that's the first thing. And the second thing is – their targets are generally on the right, nationalist military governments or religious governments. And all of a sudden, not to mention the fact that they're Israel's enemies too, all of a sudden the American military man is this deity. But that means that these guys end up acting like spoiled children and do whatever they want And they believe that they're so superior that they march into a country and they get beaten. It has nothing to do with the politicians, has nothing to do with anything. The military budget is far larger than the papers show. None of these people have any obligation to tell you the truth. No one goes to jail if they lie about casualties. So this is the heart of the matter here. It's all a lie, and it's based on ideology. And I remember that seismic shift in the early 90s, after when General Schwarzkopf was on every front page of every magazine. All of a sudden, they're doing Israel's dirty work. They went from demons to gods overnight.
Well, the anti-war movement in this country now, I still find it humorous. What amounts to any sort of anti-war sentiment in this country now is the dissident right, who the communists, we're all Nazis. You're all Nazis. Well, if we're all Nazis, it's awful funny that the modern day Nazis are what amounts to any sort of anti-war voice in the country at all. And you brought up on paper, because this is where we get down to the nuts and bolts. Because even on paper, and like you say, they lie on that, but on paper, the U.S. spends more on their military than all of these countries combined. And people look at that and they automatically assume this must mean America's the biggest, the baddest military on the planet. Well, and they do. They have some neat gizmos, technical, stuff that looks real cool when they put it on TV for you to look at as though it's a video game. And you're not supposed to notice that they're actually, when they show these bomb cams, they're actually bombing a wedding party and killing people. It's just supposed to be like something you watch with this detached sense about you. You don't think about those things. But setting all of that aside, I mean, they spend all of this money, but does it equate to superiority? And I think when you look at America, one of the things that did make it somewhat formidable, and say go way back to World War II, is the ability to mass produce. I mean, the German aircraft were highly superior to pretty much anything the Americans were putting up until the very end of the war. And yet it was just a case of America could produce this stuff. They could manufacture it faster than they could shoot it down. And it seems to me, especially when you look at China, for instance, we've sent that capability to them. We do not possess the capability to mass produce these things. China has that capability. We act as though now it's like the roles of reserve people reversed. Rather, people have this attitude like, it doesn't matter because our stuff's superior. Yes, but they have more stuff and they can knock ours down. And even if we were able to, and I think it's quite debatable we couldn't, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of this here in a minute. But even if we were able to knock down 10 of theirs to one of the U.S.'s being knocked down, China has the capability, I believe, to just keep to produce 20 for every 10 that we knock down, and it never ends. And what happens as ours get knocked down, the U.S. is unable to actually replace it. I mean, how long does it take them to manufacture one fighter plane? I don't know, but I guarantee you a lot longer than it takes China, especially when you start talking about the parts acquisitions that are all this stuff is now global now. How many of the parts are they actually sourcing from China? Well, you cut that off. We've lost the capability to mass produce in the quantities that you're talking about necessary in a really intense war scenario. And I really think that in and itself would be one of the first things that would pop up.
You're right. In Russia and China, the military production is in the hands of the state. If there's any private investment in that area, it's in partnership with the state. The U.S. is an oligarchy. Corporations and conglomerates rule everything, including that. Most of the government's privatized anyway. So that's in private hands for the sake of profit. That's a huge difference. That's where what it comes down to. The industries that make Russian and Chinese equipment are state-owned. This year, the USS Fitzgerald smashed into a cargo ship close to Tokyo. And then in August, the USS John McCain, of all things, crashed into an oil tanker near Singapore, killing 10 people. In 2017, there were several guided missile destroyers colliding with fishing boats, and there was a military seat of command vessel smashing into things in the Strait of Juan de Fuca in 2014. Giant, massive crashes. There's a spate of them. Off Jacksonville, Florida in 2012, a number of cruisers crashed into a submarine. I could go on. This is – and people were killed here. Planes are falling out of the sky everywhere. One of my favorites is just hit in military.com. A tank allegedly rolled down a hill. The parking brakes didn't work. None of the brakes worked. The radio didn't work. The thing fell apart. And this is in Slovakia, of all places, during an exercise. And they invented a story. I don't think you got to it. I sent a story where they had to – how do we deal with this? How do we keep from this becoming a meme in Russia? You know, the fearsome Abrams tank that nothing works on it. So they invented a story that this kid cut off his own leg to help his comrades. And the story – this is official. This is right in the news release. They say that the kid lost his leg, bleeding like crazy, that didn't go into shock, didn't go into cardiac arrest. No. He made a tourniquet, thought very clearly, radioed for help, failed, helped his comrades, got to the med kit, took his belt off, and answered a phone call asking for help. You know, someone was calling him, and he said, "We're in trouble." All this while blood is spurting from his leg. And I wrote, I said, "Are you kidding me? That's not how the human body works." The article said that he talked himself out of going into shock. I said, "I'm sorry, that's not how – you can't reinvent the laws of anatomy." So this is what happens. And so every time – or this recent – the tank thing is kind of, you know, big news in military circles. This is what they have to do now, because they'd be laughing that this tank was so – and whether they were all sleeping at a party, and they were all sleeping in the damn thing. How the whole crew sleeping in a tank at the same time? So they have to admit this. Oh, he was hungover too on top of it. What the hell's going on here? And so they had to invent this story of him cutting off his own. Can you imagine to try to create some profile of courage here to keep this humiliation? I mean, there are hundreds of these events a year of these disasters, because these ships and tanks are so overworked. The morale is so low. The competence level is increasingly low. The manpower shortage is severe. There are 800 empty pilot positions in the Air Force. That actually includes maintenance too. 800. They're offering – these guys are all getting six figures, and they still won't do it. So the manpower isn't there. The morale isn't there. The money is there, but it's not being properly spent. So in compensation, they pin medals on themselves. They give themselves more money, and they convince themselves that they're invincible, and have the media. You know, you remember the whole debate about embedded reporters in the 1990s in the Middle East. Well, that's now the norm. You read something in the New York Times about a military action that the U.S. is involved in. It's not true, because every word of this has been censored by the unit that journalist was embedded in before it even got to the editor. So none of it is true. So they invent these stories to cover up the fact that they are literally, not figuratively, literally falling apart.
Well, and you opened your remarks, and I'm glad you did. You opened those remarks with referencing the Navy. And I remember when all this was happening, because I was laughing about it. I was like, well, I mean, as long as the Navy doesn't have to take on cargo ships, they're still going to get out there and kick some ass. And this is one of the things that people will point to when you talk about a major conflict with Russia and China. They look at our Navy. We've got these carrier groups out there, and they'll point to Russia and China's humble naval capabilities. It's a complete joke. You look at Russia, you look at China, and they fail to grasp that Russia and China have spent their money, which is meager amounts compared to what goes into the U.S. defense budget, on actual defense. I mean, they have focused, they've spent their money, I believe, wisely when you look, get to the nuts and bolts of their, of what they've invested in and their capabilities. But people will point to, you know, this overwhelming Navy superiority. Well, we float these giant carrier groups around, which I honestly, besides from going over and kicking around little countries that can't really fight back, I think their number one purpose of these carrier groups is to remind the American people that we're ready at any time to refight World War II, because these things are giant floating targets. If you just a little bit of research into current anti-ship missile technology. These things are just, if a major conflict broke out, the last place in the world I would want to be is in one of these carrier groups, because you're just a target. And a person can go, a listener, if you want to, you can go and go on YouTube and you can look up the Falklands conflict and the ship that sunk there. There's a documentary from years ago, and I think it was the BBC. They went in and interviewed the guys that were on the British ship that got sunk. And they were talking about the guys were on the bridge, and when they realized it was an anti-ship missile coming in, I won't pronounce it right. I think it's SSX missile.
Exocet from France. Yeah.
Yeah. And when they realized that was what was coming in, they said, well, it was surreal. They said most of them went over and just looked out the window to watch it come in, because there's nothing you can do. You can't move the ship. I mean, this granted was 1980s anti-ship missile technology. One missile comes in, hits a ship, it's toast. Anti-ship missile technology now is leaps and bounds. Or, countries overhype their capability, including the U.S., but Russia and China no doubt does that as well. But the fact remains that they do. Everybody acknowledges they have hypersonic anti-ship missile technology. And yeah, I mean, if you're way out here, you're fine. But when you run one of these carrier groups, if you bring a carrier group into the Black Sea because you've gotten yourself into a major conflict with Russia, that thing is going to be at the bottom of the drink by the end of the day.
I'm really happy you brought this up. You're right to say that a carrier group is pure propaganda. They're obsolete. The Russians and the Chinese made an explicit decision. The Russians have dismantled most of their carriers. Now, the Chinese, the carrier killer, DF-26 missile, which is in Inner Mongolia right now, its range is 2,500 miles and is targeted by satellite. It's deep in the interior of the country. It's almost impossible to intercept. The American SM-6 defense system, missile defense, has a range of about 150 miles, which means it really is only be effective in the last few seconds of the flight of the carrier killer, which is the most difficult phase to hit something. And the Navy has absolutely no defense against these. The Russian version is the KH-47M2 or the Kinzhal, which is a bit better than the Chinese model. This is why that thing would be they'd have to have it so far out as to completely remove the benefit of having a carrier at all. This is why these countries don't have aircraft carriers. They're very expensive propaganda pieces, and the ignorant have no idea what a carrier killer missile is. And the range and the fact that it's pretty much impossible to get rid of and fight. But even still, they will not tell you that over the last 15 years, the Navy has sunk, no pun intended, from 600 ships to about 275 today, despite threatening every major power in the world. Now, all of a sudden, Donald Trump is saying, I want to bring the carriers up to 12. Not having any idea that this is, in the early 2000s, the Navy eliminated training for junior officers. Now they go to their assignments and they're given these CD-ROMs. Okay, here's what you have to do. They used to go to the Surface Warfare Officer School and study the basics, of everything. But that's all been shut down, despite the fact of massive increases in military budget. Forces are not being trained. Ships are not being maintained. And it keeps falling. And the ships that do exist don't. Are not being taken care of. Now, in the I've studied the Falklands conflict in great detail. The Argentinians, and remember, this is a white country. Argentina is a very, very – it's not, Guatemala here. Argentina at the time was a first world white country with a first world military. And the British suffered more losses in ships than the Argentinians did. The Argentinians lost their flagship Belsano. That was it. The British lost tons of ships. The only reason that the British won is that the U.S. talked the Argentinians down. And that was pretty much it. There's an old myth that the French gave the British the code to the Exocet. That's not true. I thought that was true for a long time. It's not. But that's the only reason. But, of course, anyone who knows anything about the British Navy knows that they couldn't field a flotilla like that if their country's life depended on it today. From 82 to now, they're about 20% of what they couldn't do that today. So, they almost were defeated. They came very close to being defeated. And now they couldn't feel that force anyway.
Well, yeah. And I remember, when they kicked off the Libyan conflict to get rid of Gaddafi, didn't the British run out of missiles like the first night? They just ran out of missiles. Well, we launched our first volley. We're out now. We're out now, mates. You know, they ran out of missiles like the first night or something. So that would be our great allies in a conflict, with a major power. And the bottom line is you've got these huge ships out there floating around. And I don't care what kind of technology you have. If somebody launches some of these missiles, it's my understanding, they skim, you know, 10 feet, whatever, off the ocean surface. Somebody launches a missile your way that flies, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times, whatever it is, the speed of sound. It's just like going back to that documentary. All anybody on those ships is going to be able to do is stand there and wait. You know, how long is it going to be till, you know, are we going to sink instantly? Are we going to burn to death first? And it just makes it, again, so ridiculous, because this is the first thing. Whenever I get into this discussion with people, it's almost 100% of the time, first thing they point to is overwhelming American naval superiority. And again, these things are, like, as you said, they're completely obsolete. Yes, we're well geared to fight World War II again, I guess. I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, as far as, you know, modern conflict, and these other countries have spent their limited budgets very wisely, and they don't plan to go out and, you know, plant themselves off the coast of America and start launching sorties. They're planning towards an eventual conflict happening on their border, off their coasts, and they're extremely, extremely well prepared for that. And the United States is not. The carrier groups, which when you talk about the Navy, that's really what they're talking about. They have other projects. I don't know if you've looked into it or not. You know, they had that, they have a stealth ship that they've been developing. And everybody who's looked at this stealth ship has said it is a coffin. They're like, this thing, you can poke holes in it. They're like, it will not survive 5 minutes in combat. These are the other projects they're working on, to become up to date with the times.
As of May 2019, China has more warships than the U.S., and they're more modern. The American ships tend to be older. China has 300 surface ships right now. They have 23 destroyers, and they've already made a decision. They're going to build another carrier. They got one in pieces from Russia. The instructions were in Russian, so that was a bit of a problem. It told you there was some delays in construction, but it's relatively small. And the crisis at this point now is so bad that when James Mattis was defense secretary, he admitted that military aircraft crashes have soared by 40% since 2013. And this guy had the gall to say that it was because of steep cuts in defense spending. Well, he knows that that's a lie. He knows he's lying through his teeth. He knows that the $700 billion figure is way too low, because so much is off budget. It's about $1.3 trillion. $1 trillion, because people don't realize the entire Coast Guard is under the Department of Homeland Security, not the military. That's not included in the military budget. There are black ops, of course. All the intelligence is not on budget, or at least not in the military budget. International relations, all kinds of aid and assistance, training, none of that is in the budget. There's so much more that's not included in the military budget. But if you put all this stuff in, it's about $1.2 trillion. Well, so it can't be money. So what is it? As of last year, say about a year ago, about half of the Navy's FA-18 Super Hornets were flyable. And about 31%, according to the Davidson Report, which is about this crisis, but 31% were ready to deploy at a moment's notice. But even just this year, 62% of the FA-18s were inoperable due to maintenance concerns and a complete lack of manpower to do anything about it. The head of naval aviation, Troy Shoemaker, says that the readiness level has been in decline for the last few years. And these guys use this disaster as a way to try to get more money. They're claiming that the budget is being cut while you could actually just see it rising, in fact, rising steeply. So if it's not the money, then what is it?
And great minds think alike, because you brought us into a perfect seg into talking about the air aspect of it. They've been working on this. What is it? This joint strike fighter now for how many years? And it's over budget. And these new aircraft that they've been trying to design, everybody that flies it is like, the thing is unflyable, because they're trying to make one plane do all of these things and it can't do any of them. And they've spent all of this money. I think a lot of people don't realize how much of our air force, our air power, I'll lump the naval air power in with it. How much of our air ability, air capability, in the wartime theater is consists of planes that are essentially 1980s. I mean, they're updating them, but the basic designs, the basic capabilities that we're back to 1980s, capability. And a lot of these planes are literally these older planes, and they just keep patching them together and keep patching them together and keep them going, keep them flying. And you have these old aircraft, they're old design, but when they try to do something new, they wind up over budget. And what do you wind up with? Something that can't fly without killing the test pilots. You know, I mean, so again, it's this much vaunted, you fly into a country that has no capability to fight back. And, you know, from an air standpoint, and well, that's really great. But when you actually talk about a real conflict with a major power that does have those capabilities, and once again, it rhymes with what we just covered on these ships. The anti-air missile capability is so advanced now. I mean, most people that have looked at this, even in passing, have read about Russia's, I believe it's the S-500 now, their system that is basically, once it's deployed, anything that flies into that zone is toast. Now, again, we have to be real. Everybody overhypes their capability, including the U.S., including Russia and China. That's just what these countries are going to do. Of course, they're going to say that. But I mean, you read independent analysis, and these independent analysis are pretty much in agreement with this. They're like, you know, once this thing is deployed and an area is covered by this anti-air capability, this notion that the U.S. is going to be able to come in, bomb everything to oblivion, and send in the troops is just, once again, it's propaganda. It's fantasy. Once these systems are in place, and again, these systems aren't offensive systems. You have to be going over there and attempting to fight them pretty much in their territory. They're not going to come to Nebraska and set up an anti-air battery. I mean, you're going to be over on their side of the world in a conflict with them. And you're this notion of air superiority that Americans are so spoiled to, it's going to go out the window, is it not?
Well, you know, other than Panama, the U.S. has not really won these wars. The Iraqi anti-aircraft batteries did extremely well against the American Air Force. It's an absolutely complete disaster. Now, I've translated some Russian casualty figures from that war. Just, you know, the initial thrust, you had about 10,000 so-called coalition soldiers were killed and 60 tanks destroyed. And the U.S., you know, they managed the media in such a way that no one even knows this. Iraq's ground forces were not surrounded and destroyed as was the U.S. and Britain in the first 7 months lost more than 300 of their newest aircraft. They lost their primary radar stations, and they were hit from the air. And it's one of the things that finally beat them. So, you know, it's not the case that even in the early 90s, they didn't have the superiority. I mean, why was Saddam Hussein not removed from power? It's because of this. And you have to know how to read Russian or listen to me to know the truth, because Russian military intelligence was saying the Americans are lying. We know exactly what happened there, the gigantic casualties that the Americans and the British took. And, you know, and the ways that they lie about casualties is really bizarre. You know, if you are wounded and then later die, you're not KIA. If a tank is disabled and goes back for repairs and, oh, it's not worth it, that's not a knocked out tank. There was one Russian officer who said that Americans they send boys from hospital to hospital deliberately to make the paper trail harder to detect. But, you know, the initial 7 month war, the U.S. and Britain lost about 300 planes. And that first 7 months, Iraqi air defenses didn't suffer at all. The British lost half their aircraft. And I have all the Russian citations on this. You know, the Air Force, the Royal Air Force, had about 300 combat aircraft. This is even later on. So in 2001, the RAF had 300 combat aircraft. 2003, they had 110. Where'd they all go? And, you know, this is – and, of course, the Iraqis and the Russians were saying they were getting knocked out of the air. you know, and what people don't realize is that so much of the fighting was done by mercenaries. I mean, the U.S. made a decision to use Arabic mercenaries to fight some of the battles. And again, this is in the U.S., you know, during Fallujah, they were dumping 200 kilogram bombs on residential areas. 4,000 guerrillas defeated 25,000 American soldiers a few months later at Al Ramani under the codename Ghost Rage, as it were. Then when Fallujah was finally taken, the defenders' bodies show burn marks consistent with chemical warfare. I piss off a lot of these veterans by showing them the documentation that the reason the U.S. defeated the Japanese at Iwo Jima was that they pumped yellow phosphorus, which is the same thing as white phosphorus, underground to get the Japanese out of their caves. That's white phosphorus. This is a chemical weapon. And I'm also, you know, I mentioned the training before. I've mentioned the fact that these guys don't get the training that they used to. The discipline is gone. I wrote something on the Green Berets recently where the new general there has completely eliminated all standards, partially because they're bringing women in. And that's an entirely separate thing. There were top secret casualty lists that President Bush was given even before the war started. They said, you know, we're looking for 10,000 American dead at the first week of the war and 30,000 if the war lasts more than 20 days. And, you know, Bush said, no, if this happens, we're not going to release it. The Pentagon afterwards bought 63,000 body bags and refused to say how many were allocated. And of course, the U.S. and Bush was very clear. The U.S. And WikiLeaks have been very clear on this. Bush said the Americans will turn against the war if they knew the real casualty figures. And I hate the fact that these kids are dying and no one even knows about it in the general public. You know, in January of 91, Light Industries had a rush order for 4,000 body bags, and they had a contract for 16,000 with the Defense Department. C.R. Daniels of Maryland, rubber crafters at Smithville, West Virginia, that had to be brought in because they were running out of body bags. And this is figures from 1991. The Russian military website, Ohrana.ru, that's an intelligence site. It's sort of more like a forum with these guys. The second Iraq war, the U.S. lost 400 tanks and about 600 combat, all aircraft total put together. So the numbers differ depending on who you read, but they lied. The casualties were extremely high. The damage done to the U.S. military was very, very bad, which is why there had to be two Iraq wars. And this is, don't forget, if you remember at the time, Saddam Hussein had to cut his army in half, a lot like Japan during World War II, because he had to have about 100,000 men on the Turkish border. Because he wasn't sure if Turkey was going to get involved as a NATO member, just like Japan had to have hundreds of thousands of men on the border of the Soviet Union. Now, on the other hand, during the Crimean War, as you mentioned, Russia was fighting pretty much the entire world with a tenth of its army because the British were bribing the Poles, didn't have a state yet. They certainly had a militia. The Prussians, of course, the Austrians eventually entered the war at the end of it, offering them the moon and the stars if they were to attack Russia, and the Swedes as well, I should mention. So most of their military was, in fact, in the far north. But no one knows anything about this. But if you read a history book today, you will see that the Russians were defeated, humiliated, and it was the monarchy that's to blame, and they're so-called backward. And yet the Russians successfully fought the entire world. And while they certainly didn't win, they also didn't lose.
And we had a few technical difficulties there. I had to kind of stop. We had to sort some things out there. And Dr. Johnson was just talking about the Crimean conflict and how the history books are telling us, you know, it was this, you know, lopsided Russia got totally kicked around. And of course, that just wasn't simply the case. And again, you can see with that context why this really, as we've gotten into our discussion on this false perception, American military superiority, why that got us thinking about these things. So I've kind of put Dr. Johnson in the spot here because we had to stop. It took us about 10 minutes for me to get all of that sorted out. So we've kind of got to pick up where we left off as best we can. And so if we kind of cover something we already have, but yeah, we know now that they lied about the casualties in the Iraq war. We know they had all of these body bags ordered. They won't tell us how many they used because, you know, that would be bad for the people to know. And yet they went somewhere. They did something with them. They didn't just put them into storage. And you have these people and like if your child, your son died in this war and you're thinking, oh, my son was one of the 200 that got killed. He must have been like inferior somehow. But no, actually it could be the fact of the matter is that these casualty rates were so much higher.
Well, let me quote Colonel Svidrigaylov in 2003. I translated this myself. He says, "The performance of the U.S. military in the first phases of the Iraq war were disastrous. They failed to perform well against Iraqi air defenses. The result was to move the operation to attack civilians. Only with the support of the media could U.S. authorities hide its enormous losses. 6 days of fighting, U.S. military has lost 15,000 soldiers, 600 tanks, and 18 pieces of the latest bomber aircraft in 1991. The convincing victory of the Iraqi armed forces were associated with well-trained and experienced personnel, as well as the availability of reliable and modern military equipment purchased in Russia, Ukraine, and China." Now, Svidrigaylov is in military intelligence. He's a retired colonel. He wrote this on a forum for other military men, especially in intelligence. And, you know, he has all the reports, everything both from the Chinese and his own. This is just – and who knows? I mean, we simply don't know. There's no way – there's no way to tell. I mean, they hide – every country hides casualties. But the U.S., because they're so concerned, and when – and that's how the WikiLeaks data that's now out shows that George Bush being really obsessed with hiding casualty figures because he was so worried about, you know, committing himself to a major war against what was almost a first world power. I mean, Iran's a first world power now. Iraq was just on the cusp of it, which I should note is something that – the U.S. is one of the great crimes of U.S. foreign policy is that you have countries like Syria, Iraq, and Libya. All three of them were on the cusp of first world status. They were rapidly developing. They had a very rational bureaucratic system, and that's what threatened Israel. If they're third world, that's okay. But these three countries were making that jump, and that they couldn't have. And that's what, to some extent, what some of these wars were all about. And that's why I couldn't handle the ridiculousness that this dug in, well trained, almost first world military just got, you know, killed 200 people. Got a couple of guys in the woods could kill more than that if they're motivated enough. Now, of course, Svidrigaylov also mentions Medvedchuk, another one, Anatoly Medvedchuk, writing in Russian Soldier magazine in 2012, says really the U.S. would have lost entirely. But it was able to bribe a few high-ranking Iraqi generals who had a problem with Saddam for one reason or another, and they defected. And that's one of the reasons that all their jets were landing in Iran, not because they couldn't handle the American Air Force. They were more experienced than the American pilots were, and they were flying mostly French Mirages and the Su, the Russian-made plane. So, you know, it it's all a lie. And I'll say this. I've said it a million times. I'll say it a million more times. Everything that the average American, even the average educated American, believes about the world is a lie, is a story, is a myth in the true sense of the word. But in no area are they more absurdly wrong than in this military thing. The last thing, you know, we talked before our interruption was this military air superiority, naval superiority. In the air, that certainly wasn't the case in the 1990s. We mentioned it just so happens I did a major study of the Falcons. I didn't publish anything on it from 1982, just last year. And you know, the British barely won. Again, it was another reason they won because the military government was talked down by Chile, by Peru, and by the United States. And the Soviets refuse, because this is an anti-communist military government. The Soviets are not going to support that. So, you know, this is the problem. You know, because so what's going to happen against a Russo-Chinese combine?
It's an amazing thing, isn't it? You have people that are aware to the point that they'll say the media is the lying media, you know, the fake news. And they're aware of that. But yet the media puts out like these things, these figures, they echo these things and they buy it up. The same people that last week were like, oh, fake news, they're attacking Donald Trump. Yet when it comes something like this, they eat it up just the same as anybody else would. You know, it's like, well, they only lie about some things. You know, no, they lie about everything. And this is a great spot. We talked, like you said, we talked about, we basically sunk the naval superiority idea. We've shot down the air superiority idea. And we've touched on, but I want to move specifically into the perception of, you know, at some point in time, you got to send in the troops and here's where we're going to shine. But no, because at some point in time, if you're talking about a major conflict, you've got to send in the troops. Well, just China has this insanely huge army. I mean, I don't know what levels of insanity and delusions would be required to think that the U.S. military, the U.S. Army, even if you combined it with the Marines, is going to be able to take on China, much less talk about fighting a two-front war with Russia and China. We'll get into the likelihood of that here in a minute. But you have this. And say, and as you've already pointed out, morale is low. And I, too, anybody I've talked to that's like recently out of the military, they're recently out for a reason. They're like, I got the heck out of there. And we've seen the stories where they've got guys walking around in red high heel shoes because they've got to get in touch with their feminine side. They've got soldiers putting on fake pregnant bellies because they need to know what it feels like for the female soldiers when she's having such a tough time being pregnant. And they spend all of this time on gender equality, all of the other rotten things. Isn't it amazing, Dr. Johnson, how people get that the government does all these stupid, retarded things, these gender equality and the diversity training and they'll sit there and point to all of this government nonsense. And yet they think that somehow the military is different. The military is somehow not affected by all of the same corrupt, utter nonsense that all of the rest of the government is obsessed with, which of course we know that's absolutely false. And how could their morale not be low in these circumstances? Like, okay, what's our training this week? Are we going to work on dropping out of a helicopter and taking a position? No, we're going to put on fake pregnant bellies and learn what it's like for a woman to walk around in high heels while she's pregnant, guys. I mean, how your military, of course your morale would be crap. Not to mention these guys are constantly deployed all over the world. And then you get the basic fact. The basic fact, no matter what kind of conflict you're talking about, and this really struck me on your Crimean War presentation, and this is a fact. I can say with great confidence this is a fact. The man defending his land, his home, his nation will always fight harder than the guy who was sent there from the other side of the world that's not fighting for his home, who's not fighting for his nation, who's not fighting for... I mean, you're fighting a war and you know that, hey, if these guys get through our position, they're going to be 100 miles closer to where my family lives. You're going to fight a lot harder and with a lot more dedication than the guy who, okay, we're going to put you on a plane, drop you on the other side of the planet, go fight for America because democracy and our ideals. The guy's not going to fight that hard. I mean, you know, you're going to be a lot quicker if you're that guy to go, yeah, this isn't working out. We can't call in an airstrike. I think we need to do a tactical retreat, where the man who's fighting for his own home is always going to fight harder. And then you get to the land aspect of that. They're talking about grunt military soldiers. And you look at China, they have this massive army. The Russians are notorious fighters. These guys know how to fight and they're hard. And you're talking about a fight like this. They would be the ones defending their own territory. I don't see any way around just a humiliating, devastating loss. Am I in any way missing the mark with that?
Well, I don't think the English language really has a word, you know, that describes what that loss is going to be like, especially given the state of the American military. There's going to have to be a false flag of some type blamed on military, the foreign military, for that to happen. Let's talk about why. And the fact that you know, the Air Force, for example, has 800 open slots, and that civilian airliners are stealing all of their best people to the point where they just had a meeting with the airline association. Let's say you're a major in the Air Force. Say you're an O4 at Andrews with the Pendants near DC. Now, you're making, according to the pay and benefit scale, you're making $115,000 a year. They'll say that it's $80,000 because they don't mention that the housing allowance is $40,000, really $38,000. Now, housing allowance being, you know, that large is only exists for one reason, and it's to hide how much these guys actually are getting. But that's only the beginning of it. Only a portion of that is actually taxable. All their bonuses are tax-free. They have subsidized life insurance. When they're deployed, it goes up 10%. Then they get food a food allowance on top of that. 30 days off a year with pay. And of course, Air Force travel packages at absolutely no cost. Then retirement after 30 years is 80% of that salary. There are no income limits. All education is free of charge. Living expenses, utilities, maintenance are covered for anyone who lives on base housing. And it's tax-free housing based on rank and family status, geographic location. This does not include bonuses. In 2018, the USAF increased its retention bonus to the maximum of $100,000, according to the September Air Force Times. And that's with, I take that with a grain of thought, a grain of salt. I think it's much higher than that. They're guaranteeing, and I have this published somewhere, they're guaranteeing that you'll make major if you come out of college and join the Air Force. And what made me, and this is sick, you know, for actual grunt veterans who have been shot and shot at. Drone pilots, they're not even drone controllers, the joysticks are getting $125,000 for a retention bonus. I thought it was a typo. These guys are in no danger. And there's something else. Speaking of the word veteran, you've noticed that that word has changed. It used to be that a veteran was the same as a combat veteran. It was somebody who was at the front or immediately supported someone at the front, like a medic or someone like that. Someone who was getting shot at. Today, veteran is someone who happened to be in the military while a war was going on somewhere, or even no war going on somewhere. If you never left Missouri, you're still considered a veteran, and you call yourself a veteran. And I have a huge problem with this. I mentioned those two guys I confronted in the Maryland 7-Eleven. You know, these guys are claiming to be combat veterans when they're hitting on girls at the bar because they slaughtered some group of, if that's even true, they slaughtered some group of goat herders somewhere who didn't threaten anybody. You know, you're a pilot with a rank of major, 7 more years in the service, $250,000 a year, including all the intangible benefits, is not outside of the realm of possibility. In 2017, the USAF announced fighter pilot bonuses of over $500,000 over several years. If you're a colonel, you make colonel, you get $10,000 for one speaking engagement at one of these military industrial complex meetings. And then, of course, when you retire, especially if you're a colonel or up, you retire. You often go to work for, you know, Lockheed or GE or something like that. And, you know, you're making huge amounts of money and you're still getting your full pension. And this is it. This is the issue. And even with that, they can't keep guys. And it's because they're being sent everywhere with inferior. Where is this money going? They hired Ernst & Young a few years ago. There's a law in Congress called the Audit the Pentagon Law. It's pretty clear what it's supposed to do. And Ernst & Young, after I guess about a year of investigation, said we can't do it, that we can't audit these people. The record keeping is so bad. No one knows anything. No one knows how much they have, where the money is going. No one has a clue where this money is going. And on top of all of this, if this crap isn't enough, at the end of the Obama administration, the USAF, actually all branches, were purging they purged the upper ranks to a great extent. I have an informant who's on the West Coast. Someone with superior ability is seen as a threat, not an asset. Promotions have nothing to do with merit, never have had anything to do with merit. And they purged hundreds of generals and admirals at the end of the Obama administration. Anyone who might be on the right of the political spectrum, they purged. They did an a pro-Zionist purge at the end of the second Bush administration, getting rid of anyone in the Pentagon who had a problem with Israel. So you have constant chaos in the upper ranks. There's this huge turnover with these guys. So that, you know, that's just the very beginning of what's going on here. It's chaos. But the fact that Ernst & Young, the biggest, best-known auditing firm in the world, gives up. Says we can't even audit one office of the Pentagon. You know that there is deep corruption, and we know that this corruption comes from the fact that they're being worshipped. That's changing now, but have been worshipped as fighters for freedom and liberty, the invincible force of the U.S. Military. Well, they don't have to follow the rules that we do if that's really what they are.
Well, one of the things that really I wanted to talk about this with you, one of the reasons is, and somebody, the casual, quote unquote, my patriot type of person, listen to this, probably think that, you know, these guys are just downing on our troops. They're just hating on our troops. But the thing is, this is a very dangerous situation, because if people don't understand the truth, they're more likely to fall into getting into one of the, you know, into a major conflict. And I'm not just talking about man on the street. You look at our horrible, corrupt, inept politicians. You were talking about, you know, merit has nothing to do with promotion. Well, politics is the extreme version of that. We don't get the best and brightest people ruling over us. We get the best liars, the most corrupt, the absolute, really, honestly, bottom of the barrel. I think you could grab the just random used car salesman anywhere, and he's probably got higher morals and higher standards than any politician. And you get into a point where you have these people in positions of authority that actually start believing this, this sort of thing. And which kind of brings us, I think, to the important, one of the really important things to think about at this is the likelihood of a conflict with a major power. Now, one could look at all the things we've discussed here and say, well, those in power understand this. I mean, they may not talk about it publicly, but they understand it. And there's no way they would get us into a conflict with a major power such as Russia and or China. And I don't think so. I don't have that view, because I look at these people, especially even if you look above the politicians, at the ones that pull the strings behind the scenes, these people are incredibly arrogant. They're control freaks. They're very arrogant, which is a very dangerous combination. They overestimate their own ability to control things, to keep things under control. And they think, oh, well, we could get into, you know, we can goad Russia this far and we can keep it. They actually have such a high, overblown sense of self-esteem. They think they have the ability to control events from getting out of their control. And history tells us that's not the way things work. Once things get snowballing, it gets out of control real fast, and it gets away from them. And we have idiots that are running things. And I think it's quite likely that these people running things would get us into a situation, to where it gets out of hand, and we wind up, they didn't go into it with the intent of getting bogged down into a major conflict with one of these powers. But because they had too much belief in their own ability to control things that they have no way of controlling, that things couldn't get out of their hands, that we wind up being sucked into one of these conflicts. So I guess the big question I would ask is, how likely do you think it could happen? And as a part of that, would Russia and China side up? And I think that's kind of a gray area, because, you know, these are separate nations with their own interests. But I think the temptation would very much be there, be like, if I don't jump in here, now is our chance to get rid of this nation who for so long has essentially tried to bully us, has caused us all these problems, has threatened us nonstop. Here's our chance to put an end to it. What do you think?
Well, the U.S. has done everything in its power to force Russia and China together. They have a lot in common. They're highly nationalist states. I mean, China is, as Willis Carter always used to say, is a national socialist state based on the Han Chinese ethnic national foundation. They have many agreements with Russia in the military realm, with all of the sanctions on both countries and the trade war on China. It hasn't not only has not hurt them, but it's helped them, because they've now built institutions with one another, and led by the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is the most significant institution in the world right now, which brings about half the global population together under Russo-Chinese oversight. They've you know, made peace with Pakistan and India, both of whom are members of this organization on the same side. The Indians just bought a huge package of Russian missile systems. Turkey has de facto left NATO, because they now work with the Chinese on a regular basis. They're getting all their missile systems now from China. They were threatened by the U.S., and the Turks said, what are you going to do? Without us, nothing's going to happen in the Middle East. You notice that all of a sudden, Saudi Arabia has become of immense importance militarily. And part of this is because Turkey is pulling out
France has left NATO more than once, has its own nuclear force, and says that in any war, they're not going to be fighting on the American side, even though they make some noises sometimes. And Germany, of course, has so many investments in Russia, a huge trading partner. One of its biggest trading partners is Russia. They're not going to listen to the American sanctions. You can't tell Mercedes-Benz they're not going to make $1 billion this year because the Americans are upset about something. That's not going to happen. And if you try to bring the court over this, well, they're going to expose a lot of crap that no one wants exposed. So if something like this – now, I'm not making any predictions here. I mean, Putin can outplay these people any day of the week. He's head and shoulders above these guys, these American idiots. But there's many variables to consider. The general stupidity of politicians. But that assumes that politicians really make the decisions here. Politicians mostly are lawyers or millionaire businessmen. Yeah, the percentage of men in the House of Representatives who've been arrested for DUI and wife beating is extremely high. In a liberal democracy, the scum rises to the top. People who can manipulate others do very, very well. Decent people don't, because you have to appeal to the mass and you need the media to promote you. So you have politicians who honestly believe that the U.S. can defeat anybody. You have unlimited money with no oversight over it. You have embedded journalists who are telling people exactly what they want to hear about the American forces. Casualty rates in previous conflicts have been repressed and lied about. You have a media who knows nothing about Chinese or Ukrainian or Russian politics, who has at least 25-year-old reporter who never leave D.C., who go to liberal groups on Capitol Hill or the CIA and get their information. You know, the day of the hard-bitten foreign reporter is over. No one's paying those guys anymore. That's gone. They're kids now who have no expertise in any particular area. This is where they're getting their information. You know, the media controls policy too, because this is where politicians get their information from. But then you have generals. Now there's been purges. It's a new group. But still, you know, they're going to be responsible for these body bag orders. Now, the purge is hard to get into someone's head, but that's part of the purge, you know, several purges over the last 10 years, or at least since 2014, that have eliminated possible problems. You don't have a stable high command, but generals usually are less enthusiastic about war than politicians are. You know, a monarch in even as early as the early 20th century, one of their role was to lead armies into battle. Now, the people who declare war are not the ones who have to fight it. In the Greek city-state, it was the rulers who actually had to go and fight the war. And that's why it was a totally male-dominated system, because they were the soldiers. Now it's completely separated. And it's separated at several levels, because it's not even regular forces. Mercenaries are being used by the U.S. all over the place to make up for these massive shortfalls. And that's not being covered. And they're not under any constitutional or legal strictures like you have these multicultural armies and soldiers from all over the world under Blackwater and Combat Solutions Limited and all these other places in Alexandria, Virginia, that they're doing this more than just food service and laundry. You know, then you have intelligence, and then you have, of course, the position of foreign governments. One of the reasons that Putin has been very, very open about Russian military capabilities, their scientific capabilities, is not to brag about what they can do, but to let the Americans know that you're not going to do anything. Now, one of the frightening things when the U.S. pulled out of the mid-range nuclear missile treaty and began increasing its production of mid-range nuclear missiles and putting them in Romania and Bulgaria, that's a problem. The U.S. pulled out of the treaty. I did a whole show on it with Sven 2 months ago. Why they needed to do that? It was an arms limitation treaty from the Reagan era. And they pulled out of it. So you have politicians now, because there's no anti-war movement. There's no media to worry about. They have no conscience to begin with. Nuclear weapons are actually on the table, which, by the way, is something that Russia completely dominates the U.S. in. The Yahoos need to know that, as I said before, the Chinese dominate in tanks. In surface ships. Russians have about four times the number of tanks that that NATO does. Russia will not fight alone. There's no question about it. It's going to be a massive coalition. How many governments in Eastern Europe that are ostensibly pro-American are going to fall the minute shooting starts? Is the British public going to want to go fight for American interests, or the Japanese public going to want to fight. The Americans want the Japanese to have a regular army again. I mean, not you know, to have a regular army, but being able to serve overseas again. They need these allies. And on top of it all, you have these countries with trillions of dollars in American debt that they're slowly getting rid of, saying, you know, this is our big weapon. We don't need nuclear weapons. We could crash your dollar tomorrow if we want to. The only people, the only politicians who have any kind of knowledge, those who sit on the subcommittees that deal with this stuff. But even there, they have an army of staffers. All of us in grad school apply for these jobs at one time or another. Staffers at a congressional committee, the subcommittees, they have specialized information. You have a few guys that do that. House members, of course, have to be elected every 2 years. They're always in the campaign trail. Senators are different. But these guys aren't trained or knowledgeable. They're not statesmen. You know, if Al Franken can become a senator, then, you know, there's really no hope there. You don't have high levels of knowledge going into this. So ultimately, you have 25-year-old reporters who never leave D.C., who go to liberal groups for their information. They're the ones who are giving information to the to politicians. I'm thinking that it would be the high command that would tell the politicians, we can't do this. We know what they have. But since the purges, that even that's questionable. So the provocations that Washington has given to Peking and Moscow have been outrageous, but they've been outplayed at every step. They got away. Russia got away with intervening in Syria and winning that war against the American finance and created so-called ISIS organization and other groups. And the U.S. sided with al-Qaeda there and publicly sided with al-Qaeda there. So, he won that. No problem. The Turkey issue, by the way, has nothing to do. They're not the Syria thing. They're getting rid of Kurds. That's a 30, 40-year civil war against the PKK, which is a communist-leaning Kurdish group. That's the point of this. They got Russian permission for this, you know. But Russia, unlike the U.S., is actually invited into the area. I don't even think Syria is all that upset at getting – because no one likes Kurds. Iraqis, Syrians, no one likes them. You know, they're – and they're American allies just because they get the money and the drugs that they need to make their life worth living. So, you know, the likelihood – I'm not going to make a prediction here. But if it does happen, it could mean the end of everything, which might not be the worst thing that ever happened.
Well, and you know, once you talk about things spiraling out of control to the point that now, as you pointed out, when you put nukes on the table, I mean, all bets are off. And again, American public is so spoiled to this notion that war is always something that happens somewhere else. That's why they're always – that's why you were talking about the lack of any real anti-war movement. That's because it's not even real to them. It's like a video game. They turn on the TV and they show them colorful or black and white images of a bomb dropping on somebody. It doesn't mean anything. It's just like watching a TV show. It's like watching a video game. It's all fun and games. You know, when the people are so spoiled – is spoiled to the notion that war is always something that happens somewhere else. It's not something that happens here. And when you talk about the hypothetical of things spiraling out of control, and we sit here and talk about it, it sounds far-fetched, but again, things can get out of control and really, really fast when you start having unknown factors coming in and this happens and nobody predicted that. And now this has escalated. Now nobody can back down. And when you talk about putting nukes on the table, all of a sudden things get real. One nuke in an American city. The American public's notion willing to go along with any sort of war is going to stop. Really quick. And that's even without getting into the fact that this nation is tearing itself apart as it is. I mean, they keep looking for scapegoats. The reason why it's this group is the reason why the country's tearing itself apart. The country's tearing itself apart. Political lines, racial lines, everything else. And the nation's already, the U.S. is already at the point of like a cold civil war within itself. You top that off with just one. American city getting nuked and the horrors, the absolute horrors of death and war, being actually visited on the American public, where it drives it home the hard way that this isn't a game. When you turn on your news and you see footage from a helicopter gunning down a bunch of guys who are just walking down the street trying to get in their van, their run guy runs out there, he's trying to drag this dead body off the street, and they machine gun him too. And you just look at that like you're watching something that's not real. You're no longer afforded that luxury. Just one nuke going off, and the U.S. is done. The country would completely implode on itself. I don't believe there's any way that, like, the nation would rally together. If we have to wipe off the entire planet, let's nuke everybody. They would be screaming for an end to it while the society implodes on itself. Of course, that's just, that's my thoughts on it. It's worth exactly what it costs you. But yeah, it's absolutely, when you start putting nukes on the table, all bets are off. And you know, I don't know that you can say anybody wins once that happens.
I think the anti-war movement was the only reason that nukes weren't on the table as far as North Vietnam is concerned. And this is, you know, it's very depressing, but in 2013, now retired Major General Michael Carey traveled to Moscow for the military exercise, the Bilateral Presidential Commission in Moscow. And the point was, of course, for the Russian and American nuclear officers to talk peace. Now, Kerry was in charge of about 500 Minuteman missiles, about 10,000 airmen total. When he got there, actually on the plane, he got drunk. And he was screaming on the plane. He had so much to drink so fast that he was in charge of saving the world. And he was, you know, he was pinching these girls' butts all over the place, and he didn't understand his interpreter. He got drunker. All these meetings, he shows up either hungover or wasted, talking about all the hot Russian girls that he was seeing. Then there was a delay in Zurich, and he was drunk, and he made a fool of himself because he got angry. How come I'm not there yet? And now students at the big military academy outside of Moscow were putting their skills on this. I don't remember exactly what they were doing, but he was wasted. This is the, at the time, the commander here. Kerry, you know, was one of the major generals in the nuclear arsenal. He was wasted through this entire thing. He looked at these Russian officers. They said, "Oh, this is all sophomoric." You know, the Russians made sure they only drank water, and he was drinking the entire time. And then he shows up to a meeting, and he's wasted even from the night before. He says, "I had two hot Russian women the night before. That's why I'm late. Sorry, guys." He showed up late to every meeting. He was slurring his speech. He had 25 vodka shots the next day at lunch. And of course, General Kerry wasn't even removed. He got a reprimand. He was given a letter of counseling. He was reassigned, and he was retired, fully honorable, everything else. And with all of this, you know, he was making, you know, $20,000 a month. He then used that money. He founded Atlas Space Operations. And he became CEO of AAC Microtech North America, Kerry Consultants, all this, which is what generals do when they retire. So this man has become a multimillionaire because he knows how to build a company that then plugs into the old system that he was just a part of. You know, and of course, that he still gets his full pension. So this man wasn't even disciplined, not even. And one of the drunken things he was yelling at one of these demonstrations was, what a jerk, Eric Snowden. He called him Eric Snowden. He didn't even know the name. And the Russian officers were looking – the notion of drinking while on duty, especially that kind of duty, was – they were absolutely – he humiliated this country. It was suppressed in the press. I got it from militarycorruption.com. Then I looked him up personally. It's all over the place. But not – you know, at the time – I don't remember this in 2013. This would have been a major scandal given who this guy is and what happened. He's screaming, my job is to save the world. We Americans can beat anybody. And he's making fun of people. He's hitting on girls at major meetings about nuclear policy and nuclear warfare. And this was one of the commanders, General Kerry. And he was, you know, he got the letter of reprimand from General William Shelton from the Space Command. And he was retired with full honors. He wasn't even disciplined, the guy. That's what happened in 2013.
Amazing. And these are the brave generals who are going to lead us to victory. That is a lot of food for thought, and we're going to wrap up. Again, I want to thank you, Dr. Johnson, for your time. Apologize for the technical glitch, but it's a discussion well worth having, and I hope we can sit down and discuss these sort of things again in the future. This stuff is really important, and when we do we have a lot of fun. Sometimes we laugh about things. We try to find humor in things, but we also talk. It's very important that we do discuss these very serious things, because these are things that can very much affect us and will very much affect us whether we like it or not in the future. And again, I invite, if you haven't already, folks, check out the Orthodox Nationalists on this network. Also, russjournal.org. That's R-U-S, not R-U-S-H. So it's russjournal.org, for Dr. Johnson's content. And as you tell, again, one of the things I was hoping to accomplish with this show, besides just the topics, we've covered, is to introduce people that perhaps haven't heard you before, to the work you're doing, because it's very good. I really enjoy your presentations. I tell people it's like receiving a college lecture, on your own time without having to go anywhere. And if we didn't live in clown world, you would be a tenured professor at a most prestigious university. That's the best I can give you.
Well, that's a high compliment. And the fact is that, I was a professor at four universities. And I was always top of the heap in terms of student evaluations. And of course, my publications blew everybody away. They knew I was good. No one wanted to get rid of me, but they all had to. And it's what I love to do. And the fact that I can't do it hurts me very much. And, I wish some of our people would put together an institution where I could use some of those skills. But when I was first back in the Voice of Reason days in 2012, 2009, I didn't think that my style would translate well on radio, because that's all I know how to talk is university lecture style. And I was the number one draw there, number one draw wherever I go. I said, "Wait, are these people crazy?" And I got an email way back when, and he said, "Yeah, it's like going back to college without the stupidity, without the propaganda. This is what I should have learned. And if I didn't go to college, now I think I did, because I got what should have been said, should have been done." Because real academic stuff is now being done outside of the academy. The pressures on professors are overwhelming. We could never talk about this kind of thing. And so I could be, and I have full financial support from my listeners and readers. I couldn't function for 2 minutes. I couldn't eat without them. And they've been there for me. And I'm pretty sure you're we have a lot of overlapping people, but I see no reason why your listeners wouldn't like me. We're doing the same thing, saying the same kind of thing, different specialties, but the same kind of thing. And I'm full time, and this is all I do. And with this kind of work, especially from my angle, translating and all this stuff, you have no choice. So that's the biggest compliment you could ever give me, and I appreciate it.
Well, yeah, and it's just it also speaks volumes that here in clown world, truth tellers all seem to be facing the same blowback, the same consequences for telling that truth. And it's, I guess in a way, it's like sifting people out, those who continue to try to stick with speaking the truth in the face of, this adversity, speaks volume to character. So again, I thank you, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, for joining me this week. I hope we can sit down and visit again sometime. It's always a pleasure. And, thank you for your time. Again, apologies for the technical glitch in the middle of the show. I don't think it's going to adversely affect anything, that we've discussed, however. And again, I thank the listeners for taking the time to tune in, and we'll see you again at some point down the road for Aryan Insights.